The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Leah Garrett. She has a new book out. It's called X-Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos of World War II, and she joins us on the phone in, Manhattan?
I am in Manhattan, yes.
Okay. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, it's a pretty exciting week for you. We were just chatting about the release this week. Tell us what's going on.
So the book came out on Tuesday in the UK and came out, no, sorry, the United States on Tuesday, yesterday in the UK. And it's been a packed week of wonderful events and a lot of coverage in the press, particularly in the UK. And it is now officially on the bestseller list in the United Kingdom, which is very, very exciting. And here we've had a number of articles going and a number coming, including from CNN, Time Magazine, and Washington Post in the coming week. So it's been moving quickly, and it's been extremely fulfilling to be able to get the story of these incredible men out to readers this week.
I saw something in the last few weeks, a headline somewhere about the book. It was a review of some sort. I didn't read it because I hadn't read the book yet, and I hate to do that. I always wait until after I read a book to read a review and then say, that review is so wrong. But anyway, that's how I first heard about the book, and I thought, wow, this sounds really fascinating. I had never heard of these people. Who were the X-Troop?
So the X-Troop were a secret British commando unit that Churchill, working with Lord Mountbatten, formed in 1942. And it was when the Germans were really doing very well in the war, and the British were in pretty dire straits. And they had been using commando units before, but what they decided in 1942 that they would create would be this special commando unit that Churchill called X-Troop, which would be comprised of German speakers. And the type of German speakers that they ended up getting into the unit, because these were the ones one could trust the most, were entirely Jewish refugees from Germany and Austria, almost all of whom had come to the UK by themselves as teenagers, either on kinder transport or their parents just saw the writing on the wall and had to get them out quickly. And they'd been living in the United Kingdom just basically trying to survive until the war broke out. When the war broke out, the British decided to intern Germans. And they didn't really think through the fact being that the vast majority of German refugees at this point were Jews. So about 7,000 were locked up in really atrocious and terrible internment camps in the United Kingdom, in Australia, and in Canada. And amongst them were these really smart, physically adept German Jewish refugees who would later become the X-Troop, because they were given the chance about a year into internment to leave the internment camps if they joined the military. And these young men were very excited about this, because they all knew the clock was ticking and they wanted to get back to Europe to rescue their families if anyone was still alive. So they wanted to be in the military, but the British military said they could not be trusted at this point. So they only allowed them into the non-combat pioneer corps, which is where they were serving until these notices started appearing on boards saying, we're looking for people to do special operations. And these were the guys who put their hands up because they were desperate to get back and fight the Nazis. So they were sent to, a bunch of them were sent to London, interviewed by MI5. And those who were selected became this very, very elite commando unit of German speakers who also were all trained in counterintelligence, which is very unusual. Usually it's separate. You're either commando or you work in counterintelligence. But they had double training, deep double training, and incredibly difficult physical training, you know, jumping off cliffs, jumping from airplanes, you know, being running through the sand while live ammunition is being fired at them. And after a year or so of this very intense training, a bunch of them were deployed to D-Day And we're really the tip of the spear as the Allies moved forward, and we're extremely crucial in the Allied successes. And I can talk, if you have questions about any of them, I can talk about sort of who they were and what they did. But also after the war, again, because they were such elite men, both as commandos and in counterintelligence, and all knew German, they were also used for the denazification efforts to root out Nazis after the war as well.
And since this was a top secret program, I'm going to assume that a lot of that information that you would have been looking for to write your book is probably still hard to obtain.
Yes. Well, I mean, part of the incredible story about these men, which I didn't even mention there, is it was so top secret that the British rightly knew that if any of these men were captured, there would be about four different reasons to execute them on site. They'd be executed as commandos. They would be executed as Germans who are fighting against the Germans. They would be executed as Jews as well. So the British decided that for every man who joined the troop, they had to take on a fake British name, a fake British persona that explained why they all had these funny accents. And they all had dog tags that had fake regiments that they were supposedly a part of as well, that also listed them as Church of England. So they would be buried under crosses if they were killed in battle. And what this meant, though, was because of, you know, this was like a deep secret activity that basically only MI5 had one list of the men's real names that was kept by a secretary there that I was extremely lucky to see while researching this book. But it's meant that it took a long time for the story to get out. The story was all over the place. A number of files I had to declassify. Mm-hmm. Some haven't been declassified yet. Most of them I was able to. And it was a pretty vast and broad research program I did at a whole range of different archives around the world. But also incredibly exciting because I could not believe that I had the luck to get to be the one to write this book. Uh-huh. I mean, we all sort of think that the stories of World War II have been told, but this book, the story of the X Troop has like 20 extraordinary stories all rolled into one. I mean, just story after story that I couldn't believe that I got to be the one who got to tell this. So the research was very intense, but it was also super fun as well. Also because I got to interview all the commando families that I could find, as well as when I was writing that there were still two commandos alive who I also interviewed.
That's a miracle in itself. You just,
yeah.
The window was closing there. There's still
it
one,
really was.
Is still one yeah. of them alive? One of them on the West Coast somewhere?
He just died about 2 weeks ago.
Oh my, oh my.
I actually, when the book was sort of about to come out and I was getting ready to mail it to him, I called his cell phone number because we'd been in touch and his wife picked up and she gave me the terrible news. But he lived such a full life. He was in his late 90s, mm-hmm. Traveled the world, wrote poetry, you know, was well beloved by a huge amount of people. So I think he was the example of a life well lived. But when I did interview him for the book, as with the case of many of the commandos, he never had changed his name back after he took on the nom de guerre of war. And when I interviewed him, he made me promise that I would only use his, would only use a pseudonym for him in the book because he didn't want anyone to know who he really was, that he was really from Germany, that as he told me, very sadly, that his parents had disappeared without a trace, and that he had this whole terrible story as a Holocaust survivor, which was part of his basic story. So nobody knew this. So when I wrote the book for this particular commando, I promised him that I would sort of keep quiet about his real name for 5 years.
Mm.
And I also interviewed him for the Holocaust Museum because I knew how important this was in their file as well. They agreed that we would sort of keep it quiet because it was too painful and he did not want to have to go there with people. So,
sure.
And the other commando I interviewed was this really amazing world famous economist called Paul Streeton. And I interviewed him through his daughter because I got in touch with him when he was already quite ill, but he was able to answer a number of questions for me. So I was very lucky that way as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I was very much aware when I was writing the book that the clock was ticking to get particularly these two men's stories out.
Yes, that generation is fading into the sunset. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO Making Radio with the Community and for the Community. Today, Making Radio with Leah Garrett. Her new book, just out, X-Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos of World War II. There were over 80 men who passed through this unit during the war, and you focus on several of them in particular, but you also tell us the stories of many others. And do you know who my favorite one was?
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Ian Harris?
You guessed it. How did you know that? Is he everybody's favorite?
No, it's just he's one of my favorites, too. And it's funny. I did an event yesterday with Oxford University, and his son is such a dear, Mark Harris, and his grandkids. And this past week, I think I've done 7 really big Zoom events, and he's come to every event with his kids, his son, Mark Harris. And yesterday at the Oxford event, they had him actually turn on his camera and talk, and it just melted my heart. Because it's not, the whole family is terrific, but in particular, just Ian Harris, I think, is just the ultimate hard guy hero who, like, is an inspiration for all of us. So I get it. I totally get that one. Well, and extremely handsome, looking like Clark Gable as well.
Well, it looked like a lot of them were pretty handsome in their time.
Yes, they were.
You have lots of photos in here. And he became my favorite. I liked him all through the book, but when he captured like a couple hundred Germans by himself, just by bluffing them, I just said, this is my guy. And then we get to the end of the book, the very last paragraph of the book, and I said, okay, that seals the deal. And readers will have to discover what happened at his funeral. We can't really say that on the radio, but...
Okay. Oh, that's right. Okay, got it.
Well, I mean...
I can discuss what he did before if you want me to.
Okay, sure.
So Ian Harris, you know, this was a group of hard guys who, you know, had been vetted by MI5. They were the best and the brightest because they had to be physically top of the line as well as incredibly intelligent. But Ian Harris had just this fearlessness to him. And so the thing that you mentioned is he was driving through Germany. The Allies are advancing. He's in the place called Osnabrück. And he sort of hears a rumor that there's a bunch of Germans over there, and he just takes his Jeep and drives by himself to see what's going on and ends up finding an entire platoon of Germans. And the commanding officer comes out and says, "Who are you?" This guy in a British uniform, and he lies, and he gives himself a higher rank than he actually has. And he feels completely in danger because he doesn't, he just has his gun, but he doesn't really have, he has no backup whatsoever, and he knows that the German commanding officer can just shoot him. So because he's this handsome, very charming man, he takes out some cigarettes and offers him a cigarette, and the German says, "Oh my God, I cannot believe you have those cigarettes. I love those cigarettes." So they smoke a bit, and they start chatting, and the guy says to him, "So you want us to surrender?" And Ian Harris says, "Yep, you're going to, you need to surrender." And the guy says, "Why should I?" And he says, because it's all over. And the guy says, "But we have better weapons than you do." And Ian Harris says, "No, you don't." And so they actually have a shooting contest. And Ian Harris, of course, wins because he wins at everything he does. And the guy ends up surrendering. And there's this famous movie clip of Ian Harris driving with hundreds of captured Nazis walking behind him, captured Germans walking behind him. And that was just the start of it. I mean, the way he got wounded, I didn't put this in the book, but he had an eye patch his entire life because he was wounded after crossing the Rhine and getting an incredibly fierce battle with fanatical Hitler Jugend and killing a slew and capturing a slew of them until he was hit by shrapnel in the eye. And he got a citation that said, like, "Few in the ranks of history have ever acted as bravely and heroically as Ian Harris." So there you go.
Well, that is in the book. So
yeah,
that is really, he's the guy. Okay, let's go back to the beginning, though. When they first start picking these guys and they go to Wales to train them and they say, okay, you're going to have to billet with people in the community. And so they go and they start living with people in their houses, and they supposedly are these English soldiers. And it's so sweet. These people in this little town in Wales are around these guys, and they're going, huh, why do they have German accents?
Right. They are English, as they said about them, yes.
That was so cute. And
it's the culture clash. I mean, can you imagine, like, intellectual, sophisticated young men from Vienna and Berlin, and they're with these Welsh local families. There was a woman who billeted with them called Miriam Rothschild, who was married to one of them, uh-huh. and she was very protective and loved the extra person. I can't remember the exact quote from the book, but she said something like, you know, where other British soldiers would be drinking beer, these boys would be talking about Schopenhauer. Mm-hmm. So they were very different from, you know, the standard. And as the Welsh people said, and they were so polite. So they were these polite boys. They weren't drinking heavily, and they were very intellectual. And they had to pretend that they were Brits and, you know, take on these accents and, you know, eat the food and be part of this culture that must have been radically new and strange to them as well.
Well, probably one of the heaviest things in the book is what Fred Gray ends up doing. And just that's the most bizarre one, because he's got this pen pal, and I'm not going to give away anything about his pen pal, but that was totally bizarre.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, and he wants to rescue his parents from a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And that's quite a story.
Do you want me to tell that story? I can tell it.
Well, if you want. I mean, it's pretty heavy stuff. You want to give that away to readers? You want to just make them want to read the book?
Okay, that's a good point. So readers, read the book, because one of the really unusual things about this book is, look, we're used to books about Jews and World War II and the Holocaust, and we know where that all goes. And I don't know if you'd agree with this, but this is a really optimistic book about these boys who are given the chance to fight back and avenge and, you know, get their own back and fight Nazis and capture Nazis and interrogate Nazis and change the course of the war, but are also take the opportunity to rescue their own parents or search out their own families in Europe. And I think it's actually a very, very optimistic story. It's very different from sort of how we tend to think about Jews in this era, because this is a story of men who had agency and took control and did some really phenomenal things, not only for the warfare effort, but for their families as well.
I agree. I think it's optimistic, despite the way they are treated before the war and after the war. These guys, they kept on going. They kept on fighting. And I think something that I'd like to point out that you clarified so well in the story is that I initially thought, before I read the book, okay, X Troop, it's a bunch of guys like in the Dirty Dozen. They're all together. They're all running around doing this stuff. But that's not the way it was. They were separated. They were split up. Explain.
Yeah, okay. So it's really interesting. And as far as I know, there was never a commander unit in history that was so carefully parceled out as this group. So while these guys are undergoing training in Wales, their commanding officer is this incredibly decent, brilliant Welsh man, not Jewish, called Brian Hilton Jones. And he recognizes, geez, these guys are really different from the standard. I mean, they're so smart, they're so determined, they're so focused. Because look, for all of them, the clock is ticking, because they have to win this war or any family members they have left will be killed. So it's like very, very personal. And so he's overwhelmed by how incredible these guys are. So they make a decision right before landing at D-Day that this unit is so unique and so important that they cannot fight as their own unit, because if they do, let's say there's a roadside bomb and you wipe out half of them, that's it. These guys are way too important for that. So what they do for D-Day is they take them all in groups of twos and threes and fours, up to about five, and they put them with existing commando units, like three commando or all these other existing commando units. There was quite a few in the British Army. So that each commando unit would have a little handful of these men who would be the pathfinders. They were always taking leadership roles, would lead the way. And so it was really intriguing and strange for them, because while they had trained together in Wales for up to a year for some of them, suddenly they were parceled out in these groups to these commando units with men they'd never met before. I mean, they basically met the other men in Southampton in the week before the war. And then they were expected to take on these leadership roles. And they did. Like, immediately with landing at Sword Beach, these guys were finding the ways through the minefields by capturing Germans and asking them where to go. But it was really an education on their feet. One of them was given on the way down to the boats over to the landings, given a bike and said, hey, you should be with the bicycle troop. And the other members of the bicycle troops had trained for months on how does one ride a bike through, you know, the Normandy fields in order to speed ahead and capture whatever needs to be captured. He was given about 5 minutes, and that was pretty typical of these guys. And so it's even more extraordinary than that in all of these commando units in the war diaries, these are the guys who rise right to the top, even though they've had no training with any of these different units. And that was the case through the whole war. So they all were, and it's part of, I think, why the book wasn't written before, because it was a really big story for me to have to go to. I couldn't just go to one British war diary. I had to go to one for each of the different commando units. Uh-huh. To figure out and make sure that whatever we had from the interviews with the men matched the actual history, which it almost always did. But that was the story through the war. They were always with other units and playing a really crucial role with those other units.
That poor fellow who was forced
and
into
very
the,
unusual.
That guy who was given the bicycle right at the last minute.
Oh my God.
He has to jump out of this landing craft with this bicycle and this massive pack and all these weapons, Tommy gun, poor guy.
It's incredible, 50-pound foldable bike. One of the other commandos who landed on a different ship and saw the boy struggling off, and there's photos of all this in the book, with the bike, said something like, I can't think of anything worse to go to war with than a bicycle. And these were not like our nice little light mainstream bikes. Uh-huh. They were heavy, clunky, awful things. But they were given them because, particularly for his group, they had to ride ahead and get to Pegasus Bridge really quickly because mm-hmm. that was so important. And they did.
Yeah.
Well, he did. Yeah.
That's quite a story. The book is X Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos of World War II. Leah Garrett wrote it, just out. And Leah, you alluded to it a moment ago. One of their main duties when they split them up and parcel them out with these different groups was, as you said, to interrogate prisoners on the spot, because this was crucial. You couldn't wait to take the prisoner back somewhere and have someone interrogate them a week or two later. You had to know right then.
Right.
And these guys did it. And their language skills really stood them in good stead. One of my favorite stories was where the guy is, he's sneaking around and he's behind the lines, and suddenly a German notices him and demands to know, you know, he's like, halt. And the guy is such a quick thinker. He replies in German, he says, well, didn't they tell you that there'd be a patrol out here?
And, and he captures them, of course. He brings them back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this was really the most crucial aspect of what they did. And there had been nothing that existed like this before in the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so a bunch of them, I always think about the story of the landing at Sword Beach, and a group of them were put with a commando unit to land at Sword Beach, which was when they landed, it was a bit later when the slaughter was really quite bad, and they sort of landed a bit off to the side. So as they landed, this whole commando unit, immediately half of them are wiped out landing at Sword Beach. And one of the ex-troopers, Monfort Gans, he remembers his training, you know, get off the beach, get off the beach. And they all know that, but of course it's terrifying and you're panicking, you don't know what to do. And half of them are wiped out, and he leads the rest of them sort of off the beach, and he immediately runs into a bunch of Germans. And he says to them in German, as he's capturing them, what's the path off the beach? Where are the mines? And he gets the Germans to lead the rest of the commandos off the beach so that the rest of them aren't killed. And then they make their way through Normandy. I mean, he basically effectively saves half of the entire commando unit in that moment because of his cool detachment and ability to think on his feet and use his German. And it worked.
Because mm-hmm.
the Germans were so freaked out, they were like, wait, what?
mm-hmm.
There's a Brit, and I think he used very colloquial German as well So it completely doubly freaked them out, and it was successful. And this happened over and over again throughout the war.
Leah, you mentioned how they weren't treated very well by the British before the war, especially once the war was declared officially. They weren't treated very well. Just like in this country, the Japanese Americans were treated badly. And then after the war, when you would expect these guys to be welcomed as heroes for all the things that they had done, they weren't treated very well again, were they?
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the Japanese, because I'm writing an editorial today for CNN that they're going to put up this weekend about the ex-troop. And I do talk about the Japanese and how this group was also interned. And I also talk about, you know, how we treat our refugees and our immigrants, because these guys were despised outcasts who, like, basically turned the tide of the war. After the war, the British had a few other commando units, which were commando units of people whose countries had been invaded by the Nazis. So they had a Polish commando unit, they had a French commando unit. And those commando units, the men were naturalized. This commando unit, and we can only suppose why this was, were not naturalized. And Brian Hilton Jones fought, their commanding officer, fought fiercely to get them naturalized. And it actually took a few years for that to happen. And it was incredibly difficult, because this meant that they were stateless, effectively, after the war. They couldn't get pensions. They didn't know what their futures were. And eventually, the British government agreed to give them naturalization. But this was even happening while these boys were at the forefront of capturing Nazis after the war and compiling evidence for the Nuremberg trials. They were in this strange void, but eventually by 1946, they started to be naturalized. But it's interesting, though, that in all the interviews that were done with the men in the 1980s and 90s, which I found in different archives all over the world, the internment struggles and the naturalization struggles for them were actually a very minor note. Uh-huh. What was much more major for them was the fact that the British had given them arms and allowed them to fight. And I would say that actually overall, they were really grateful to the British and somehow managed to overlook that treatment for the larger opportunity they felt they had been given to fight on the side of the British.
And they went on with their lives, and a lot of them became Christians. And a lot of the ones who died still have crosses on their graves, and there's memorial in Wales to them that you talk about at the end of the story, and there's some powerful stuff in here, and this is quite a book, and we really appreciate you talking to us about it today on the program.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, when they'd all taken on their fake personas, they had all had to pretend that they were Church of England, and so after the war, a number of them just kept being the person they became in those moments of transformation. So a lot of them raised their kids not knowing that they were Jewish, continued to be Church of England, and continued with those names. I think in large measure because the past had been so painful to them, and that this was a sort of a better future for them, I think.
Time to move on. Well, thank you for your time, Leah.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody.
My pleasure. The book is X-Troop, The Secret Jewish Commandos of World War II. Leah Garrett wrote it. It's already a bestseller over in the United Kingdom. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.